mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low and keeping you company tonight. It's the show that explores the amazing, the remarkable, the downright weird. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and you're listening to Speaking of Strange. And it's that time of year. Can you feel it in the air? I don't know where you are, but where I am, oh yeah, it's nice, it's chilly, the air is dry, the leaves are crisp. It's the Halloween season. It's the time that we enjoy the best, and it also happens to be peak season for the Brown Mountain Lights. And this is a very important year, you know, when it comes to the Brown Mountain Lights. The reason is that the very first time the Brown Mountain Lights appeared in a journalistic article was 100 years ago. It was September of 1913. And yet, there are apparently reports that go back far beyond hundreds of years, the locals say, and, you know, Native American legends and whatnot. So, being the centennial year, and by the way, a lot of stuff happened 100 years ago, apparently, because in 1913, that's when the Grove Park Inn was built. That's when the Asheville Masonic Temple was built. And now, you know, the Brown Mountain Lights first appeared, that number 13. We've talked about this a lot, Forrest.
Number 13 keeps popping up.
Yeah, well, you know, you are an historian of sorts. I think it's safe to say, you know, we both are into history, and sometimes I think about the role the number 13 plays in local history, and I'll just kind of run through off the top of my head some of the sort of scenarios in which 13 appears around here. It sounds cliched, I know, but it's true. I mean, for example, the Battery Park Hotel, where Asheville's most famous brutal murder occurred in 1936. Well, it's 13 stories tall. One of the most haunted buildings in Asheville was the Battle Mansion before it was torn down, and that was the home of News 13. In fact, the very station that we are at right now, recording this radio program, is located at 13 Summerlin Avenue. Asheville's largest mass murder killing spree occurred November 13th of 1906. The first police officer who was killed was badge number 13. The Shelton Laurel Massacre that occurred during the Civil War around here was the murder of 13 men and boys, the youngest of which was 13 years old. And of course, George Vanderbilt was really the guy who brought all of the industry and wealth and influence to this area. And that wealth came from Cornelius Vanderbilt, who had 13 kids. I mean, 13 just keeps popping up. And so I think that's one reason that this is an interesting year. You know, 2013, I'm not a numerologist, but if we had a numerologist on the program, I'm sure that person would give us deeper insight into the significance here. Are you into numerology at all, Shelley?
Not really.
No? Okay. No. Well, so here we are, 100 years from 1913 to 2013, since the Brown Mountain Lights first officially made it into the record books. And, again, we have people who listen to this show all over the world, so I will say, simply enough, the Brown Mountain Lights are a world-famous mystery. These are just weird, unexplainable illuminations that appear on this ridge in the middle of the Pisgah National Forest, about an hour's drive or so east of Asheville, close to Morganton, North Carolina. And this year, as a matter of fact, this month, the Burke County Tourism Development Authority has finally released the first sort of official government-endorsed overview of the Brown Mountain Lights, and they hired me to write this, which I find to be a great honor. And the wonderful thing is they are giving these booklets away for free. And if you want to get a copy of this, you'll find it available at various places, especially around Burke County. But the best thing is to go to Morganton and walk into the visitor center there, which is open, I believe, just during, you know, regular business hours, 9 to 5 kind of thing, and go in there and grab a copy. But I have one in my hands. Forrest, you have a copy. Shelley, you have a copy. It's nice, isn't it?
It's very nice. Nice glossy sort of magazine print.
Yeah. It's a full color, as Forrest said, glossy booklet. And it's called Brown Mountain Lights, a viewing guide. And on the cover, you'll see a depiction of some blue ridges with some little lights there. And I figure what I'll do here is maybe just go through and read a few little sections from the book, and we can discuss it, because, Forrest, it's great that you're in the studio, because it's funny, even if you weren't the producer of this show, I would like to have you in the studio anyway for this hour, because you were with me and the Lemur team on many of the occasions that are documented in this book, camping out up there.
Right.
In fact, your father, John Connor, not only has camped with us up there, he is a famous geologist, but he even appeared on the National Geographic special that called Paranatural that we did that featured the lights. Right? And, in fact, maybe your dad's even in here. I don't know if he is or not. I don't recall. But let me just read the introduction to the book. The Brown Mountain Lights are a world-famous topic of mystery and debate. For more than a century, locals, tourists, scientists, and researchers have been baffled by this weird and complex phenomenon. Most people think of the lights as a wondrous, colorful display on dark ridges at night, and yet an entire subculture associates the enigma with UFOs, underground bases, conspiracies, reality warps, and high strangeness, similar to the Bermuda Triangle. In this guidebook, we'll focus on the display itself. Despite fascinating photographs of weird illuminations presented for years, some who have never seen the lights are convinced they don't even exist. There is only one way for you to know. You must venture out and look for yourself. I have been investigating the phenomenon for decades. In this guidebook, I'll give you a solid understanding of the mythos behind the lights and tips on how to properly observe the mountain yourself. All the while, I will maintain a somewhat cautious and neutral view on what they may be. After all, they are a great mystery, and though there are many theories, no one knows for sure. Hence, the beauty of this rare and mystical slice of Americana. That's what it is.
It's a piece of Americana.
It really is. So, you know, the guidebook goes into the history and people I met who have seen them. I have seen them on a number of occasions. Forrest, do you remember the first time you ever saw the Brown Mountain Lights?
I do.
Let's hear your story.
Actually, the only thing I've really seen is a little twinkle of them. I've not seen them in full force.
Mm-hmm.
We were camping one night. Was it Lizard Rock?
Mm-hmm.
And we had our camera set up. It was kind of a overcast night where the clouds were sort of coming in and out, and we were kind of all disappointed that we weren't going to be able to see anything.
Right.
But there's one point where it sort of cleared up for a few minutes, and they're looking that direction. All of a sudden, it starts. I thought it was a star or something that had come out, but it popped up for a second, went away. Then, probably about 45 degrees down from it, another one popped up and sort of faded out. Then it did that for about 5 minutes, and that's all I saw on that one night. About a 5 minute show.
Okay, well now, Shelley, you appeared in our... You've actually been on TV twice related to the Brown Mountain Lights, the National Geographic piece, as well as a Discovery Channel piece.
Mm-hmm.
But you haven't seen them, have you?
No, I was present when they were captured on film with night vision, And but my station was to the left of all of the action. Everybody else got to see something, but everything was blocked by trees and rocks for me. So
you were at Wiseman's View that night?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I could hear the excitement, but I couldn't see it.
It just goes to show how rare it is.
Yeah.
I mean, for over 20 years, I've been going up there, and I've only seen what I would consider the real Brown Mountain Lights maybe a half dozen times. And when I, looking here through the guidebook, the new Brown Mountain Lights book, let me point this out also. Because this was created by the Burke County Tourism Development Authority, and it's designed to give away for free to help their tourism, I got permission to put a free PDF of this on our website, brownmountainlights.com. So wherever you are in the world, if you want to see it, it's easy. Just go to brownmountainlights.com, and you can click the cover, and you can read it in its entirety. But, the funny thing is, we have these stories that have been passed down, saying that they've been seen for hundreds of years. But we, as historians, are always looking at specific reference points that have been recorded. And there is one that goes back to 1771. We're coming up on a break here. And when we return from the break, I'm going to tell you what was recorded in 1771. I'm also going to read an excerpt about the lights from 1913. And then I'm going to tell you about a man named Tommy Hunter. And Tommy Hunter was the only person I ever talked to in all my research who actually touched one of the Brown Mountain Lights. Can you imagine that? It's one thing to see it in the distance. This guy walked right up to one and touched it. What happened to him? I'll explain when we return. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren. It's the program where we dig into the amazing, the remarkable, the downright weird. It's called Speaking of Strange.
So you think you can tell?
we play, well, music that either comes from maybe a popular horror movie or something else that captures the spirit of the season. This piece right here is from one of my favorites, The Ninth Gate, with Johnny Depp. It's a good movie. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. If you've never been to Europe, it kind of captures the flavor of Europe a bit. At least the good parts. There's a lot of stuff about Europe not to like. Like the bathrooms. Right, Shelley?
Right.
Like, A, it's made for midgets, and B, it's really filthy.
Well, you're lucky if there's a toilet seat.
Yeah.
You're really lucky if there's toilet paper.
Yeah, yeah. And it was like that in London just as well. So, yeah, welcome back to Speaking of Strange. I'm Joshua P. Warren, and hey, it is the Halloween season. So if you want to see some spooky pictures and some creepy video, you need to check out World's Wildest Ghost Photos. It's free. It's a section on my website, joshuapwarren.com. There is no period after the P. Go to joshuapwarren.com and look up World's Wildest Ghost Photos, and you'll see some crazy stuff. And, you know, I see a lot of hoaxes, and I've only posted pictures that I believe are more likely than not credible. So I hope you'll investigate that. We're talking this hour, however, about the Brown Mountain Lights. And, in fact, you'll see some stuff related to Brown Mountain there, too, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Let me just tell you a little bit about the history of the Brown Mountain Lights, according to the Brown Mountain Lights booklet that I wrote. Locals will tell you that Native American legends regarding the lights go back hundreds of years. And in 1771, Gerard de Brom, a German engineer, recorded strange experiences while exploring the area. He was intrigued by unexplainable sounds in the mountains. In his diaries, he wonders oddly if the noises could be created by the spontaneous ignition of nitrous vapors carried by the wind. It is perhaps impossible to verify whether these early accounts are significant. However, reports of the lights exploded in the 20th century. On September 24th of 1913, the Charlotte Observer published an article titled "No Explanation. Burke County's Mysterious Light Still Baffles Investigators." The article states, quote, "The light rises in a southeasterly direction from the point of observation, just over the lower slope of Brown Mountain, first about 7:30 p.m., again about 20 or 30 minutes later, and again at 10 o'clock. It looks much like a toy fire balloon, a distinct ball with no atmosphere about it, and as nearly as the average observer can measure, about the size of a toy balloon," end quote. It further goes on and records, quote, "Many have scoffed at this spooky thing, and those members of the Morganton Fishing Club who first saw it more than 2 years ago were laughed at and accused of seeing things at night as a result of common human frailty. But as more and more persons have seen it, various attempts have been made to explain the mystery," end quote. So we can therefore say with certainty the lights were definitely a hot topic in 1911. Now, since then, they've been investigated, of course, by a lot of different scientists. I mean, once by the U.S. Weather Service and twice by the U.S. Geological Survey. Even the Smithsonian conducted an expedition. And nobody's ever really had a good explanation. I mean, in 1922, in a geological survey, a guy named George Mansfield, he studied them, and in his official report, he said he thought the lights were 47% auto headlights, 33% locomotive lights, 10% stationary lights and 10% brush fires. Well, many of the locals thought this report was pure hogwash because the lights had supposedly been seen, you know, long before autos and locomotives. Plus, in 1916, a great flood wiped out transportation routes, and there were no trains or autos in the area for more than a week. However, the lights continued to be seen. Now, that said, let me talk a little bit about this guy, Tommy Hunter, who told me he touched one of the lights. Because, you know, it's one thing to see a light in the distance and not know exactly what you're looking at. But when you're right there next to it, that's a whole different story. And I'm very lucky that I got to talk to Tommy Hunter, because he's dead now. And I got to not only talk to him, but also talk to a lot of the witnesses who were there with him when this happened. He was up at one of the overlooks there. There are a lot of different places from which you can see Brown Mountain, but there is one sort of official Brown Mountain overlook off of Highway 181. And it's actually really nice now. They have picnic tables there, and they've expanded the parking space, and they keep it very manicured. I mean, Forrest, you remember how rough it was when we were doing our research.
Right, and then we went up there one evening, and boom, they'd done a total makeover in the thing, and I'm sure I've not been up there in a little bit, and I'm sure there's even more stuff now like you were talking about there.
Well, yeah, they have a nice sign, and I mean, they've really done a good job. At least once in a while, taxpayer money is used properly. So this fella, Tommy Hunter, was at that overlook in 1982. And I think he told me it was sometime in like late August. I can't remember exactly. I got it written down somewhere. But he said that he and I think there were about 9 people there. Many of them were his friends and family. One of them I talked to is even currently an officer in the Air Force, and she didn't want her name to be mentioned because she was concerned about being associated with anything that was weird or controversial, and we understand that. But I did talk to her, and she verified this account was true. So Tommy Hunter is standing there with this group of people. All of a sudden, a gasp flows through the crowd because a ball of light comes bobbing up onto the overlook. The actual site where the cars are parked, you know, a ball comes right up there too. And Tommy Hunter said that it was a few times larger than a basketball, kind of a bright yellowish color, and hovering about 3 or 4 feet above the ground. Well, of course, everybody gets freaked out and starts running away from it, except for Tommy Hunter. He's kind of like me, I guess. He's got his wires crossed. You're supposed to run away from things like this. He instead ran toward it, and he got right up there next to it, and everybody's screaming at me, "Get away from it! Are you crazy?" It's like that scene in Fire in the Sky, when you know, the guy's out there looking at the flying saucer, and they're saying, "Get back into the truck, you dummy!" He goes over to this light, and he reaches out, and he touches it. Now, what happened when Tommy Hunter touched a Brown Mountain light? We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'll tell you. It's funny because, you know, the first time I ever saw a ghost, I touched it. And I can relate somewhat to this sort of experience. Yeah. What happens when you touch a Brown Mountain light? I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange.
Thank you.
This is from a movie that kind of scared me a little bit when I was a kid. It's called The Entity. And if you've never seen it, it's worth watching as an adult for a lot of reasons. Forrest knows what I'm talking about. The special effects were quite intriguing. But, yeah, it's about a woman who's being, harassed by a ghost. But I tell you what I thought was scary was the very last scene. Do you remember the very last scene? Okay, we're not gonna spoil this for people. We could, because this movie's been around for probably 30, 40 years now. But, I don't know, it almost gives me a little shudder, just like the very last scene. Of the entity. I wish I could talk about it, but I wouldn't do that to you. You haven't seen it, have you, Shelley?
I have seen it.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you remember the very last scene?
I think I know what you're talking about, yeah. That I can't talk about.
I mean, it's not like a big deal, but there's just... Honestly, I just got like a real shudder. You saw that, didn't you?
That was a real... That was a real shudder.
Sometimes I say that and I don't really have one, but that was a real one.
That was a real one.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Welcome back to Speaking of Strange. It's a Halloween edition of the program, you know? And amazingly enough, next week is going to be the Halloween edition. Because that's going to be our last show before Halloween. Hopefully there won't be a ball game. Or something like that. Are we looking good?
I'm still trying to do research and find out.
Okay. Because if we get preempted, don't send your hate mail to me. Send it to Brian Hall. Because if we get preempted...
NC State University.
Right. The big Halloween show. You know what? Forrest, you remember... This is also before our time, but Argosy used to be a big men's magazine back in the 60s.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, they actually had an edition there, an issue, I should say, of Argosy, December 1968. And right there on the front cover there, it says, the UFOs you can see right now. And there's a nice big article about Brown Mountain, the Brown Mountain Lights. It says, come see the flying saucers. You're looking at that, aren't you, Shelley?
Yes.
Yeah. So even, you know, 1968, this was the kind of, I guess, atmosphere around the Brown Mountain Lights. It's pretty cool. In fact, I have that copy of that magazine because a guy heard me on the radio, and he knew that I was into the Brown Mountain Lights, and he was at some old yard sale or something, and he saw that and thought, I bet Joshua Warren would like that. So that was very cool. If you're listening right now, sir, thank you, because that was very nice of you to send me that. Before the break, we were talking about Tommy Hunter, the only man I ever talked to who seemed very credible, who apparently touched one of the lights. So, everybody's freaking out, right? He walks right up, and he reaches out and touches the thing. Now, we're talking about a ball of light a few times larger than a basketball. Now, here's the thing you have to understand. What happened next... can be told from two different perspectives. One is his, and the other is all the people who are looking at him do this. From his perspective, when he touched it, he said it felt like he had stuck his finger in an electrical socket or touched a spark plug, I believe he said. It shocked him pretty darn good. He said it rattled his teeth, you know. And... yet, he didn't, in his mind, lose consciousness. On the other hand, the people I talked to who were looking at him said that they thought he almost did, because when he touched it, the light dimmed for a second, and he started to fall backward and look dazed. So it didn't knock him out, but it seemed to come pretty close to it. And can you imagine the hysterical... environment that night when people are watching this guy touch this thing? That's, I mean, God, I would give anything to be there. Yeah, I think I would. You know, it's easy to say that, but I think I would. But think this guy, he had no idea. At least I have his experience to go by now.
How big was he?
I don't know. I talked to him on the telephone. Oh. I didn't meet him in person, yeah. So he goes over, he touches the thing, but it does not dissipate. So if this is a purely electrical phenomenon, you might think that he'd touch it and it would maybe discharge it or something. Instead, when his hand withdrew, it brightened back up to its full state, and then it continued bobbing around, and then it floated right back off down into the valley and into the woods. So regardless of what this actually is, it seems to be electrically oriented, and it's quite stable. So that makes you think that it is connected to a very significant element of the mountain, you know, some kind of a power supply. But, you know, when you look at all the theories, you know, we could talk for days about the theories. Ralph Lell, he said he knew exactly what the lights were. Do you remember who Ralph Lell was, Shelley?
I remember you talking about Ralph Lell.
Yeah. He lived up there near Brown Mountain, and he was very actively studying the lights in the 1960s. He even wrote a little booklet about his work. Ralph Lell claimed that he knew exactly what the Brown Mountain lights were. They were the product of aliens. Because he started going up there to the mountain and flashing lights at the lights and telepathically communicating. And he worked out some type of a code with the lights. And they told him to go to a certain spot on Brown Mountain during the day. And when he went there, all he saw was a big, bare rock face at the end of this old, rugged wooden trail. Turns out, however, it wasn't actually a rock face. It was a camouflaged door. And he went into the mountain and found himself in a crystal cave. A cave just filled with all kinds of crystals. And that is where he met the visitors, the beings. And they took him onto their spaceship and flew him off to the planet Pee-Wan. You know the planet Pee-Wan, right, Shelley? You learned about that in elementary school. And this journey was eased quite a bit because one of the aliens, a woman named Noma, was an attractive lady in bra and panties. See, that's the kind of abduction I want to have. I can deal with that. So they took him off, and they showed him what you might think of as movies, which gave him an overview of how that humans were seated here on this planet, and typical kind of stuff like how we're going to ruin it if we don't, you know, change our ways and all that. So everybody thought Ralph Lell was nuts, but here's what I will tell you. I'd never met Ralph Lell because, unfortunately, he decided to run for Congress. And after that, he supposedly killed himself. What's interesting is that he had a little shop called the Outer Space Rock Shop Museum. And if you went to his shop and you paid him a couple of dollars, he'd take you into the back room and show you what he claimed was the mummified body of a little alien that he brought back. And after he supposedly killed himself, somebody or some organization went in there and bulldozed his shop to the ground, erasing any trace it was ever there, and nobody has any idea to this day whatever happened to Ralph Lell's alien mummy. I've had a bounty out there for a while. I'd love to have that thing in my museum, but the best I can do is, well, I have a replica of it in my museum, as well as one of the actual photographs taken by Timothy Green Beckley, who is our friend there in New York, who publishes all these wonderful books, including like the Commander X books. And so Nobody knows if Ralph Lell was onto something or not, but what I find interesting is I talked to so many people who knew him, and they all say he presented himself as a very rational, logical guy. That you didn't see him and just be like, oh, well, this guy's obviously crazy. And sometimes Ralph Lell would pack a little lunch, and he would say to everybody, hey, I'm going to go off and hang out with the aliens for a while. And they'd say, oh, yeah, sure, whatever. And he'd go walking off by himself with just a little bag of lunch into the woods. And he'd be gone for 2 weeks. And then he would come back out, and everybody would say, where have you been? Because he looked just as clean and clean-shaven as the day he walked into the woods. And he'd say, well, I've been with the aliens. They took me around. They showed me around. Are these aliens? Well, if you read the Brown Mountain Lights viewing guide, which, again, is available for free at brownmountainlights.com. That's all spelled out, brownmountainlights.com. You can see that picture. And you also, and again, that's thanks to Timothy Green Beckley. Okay? And also, you'll go, you know, deeper into some of these weird theories. But what do I think they are? Well, I'll tell you when we come back. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange. Winding down hour number two of tonight's Speaking of Strange, but next hour, well, we call that the Dark 30 Hour, and that's when we dig into the material that's not for the kiddies, not for the easily offended, so that may or may not be appropriate for you. And let me tell you, the stack of stories I have tonight kind of rivals what was on last week's Dark 30 Hour. So, yeah, it's going to be crazy stuff. I don't know what's happening in the world, but it is 2013, and it is October, so we shouldn't be surprised that so much weird stuff is occurring. I hope also that you'll go check out the free PDF of Brown Mountain Lights. I wrote it, and it's at brownmountainlights.com. And if you happen to be in this area of North Carolina, go to Morganton. Go to the visitor center. If you're lucky enough to see Ed, tell him I said hi, and pick up some free copies of Brown Mountain Lights, a viewing guide. So, you know, I could talk for days about what the Brown Mountain Lights may or may not be. And, you know, when you talk to different scientists and and enthusiasts, they'll give you all kinds of opinions. But ultimately, I think that most of the brown mountain lights are a natural phenomenon similar to ball lightning. That there are some special characteristics of the mountain that produce these lights. And if you want to know in detail what my idea is here, you got to read the booklet. But, you know, my team and I made the cover of a science journal, the Electric Spacecraft Journal, in 2004 for experiments that we did reproducing a phenomenon similar to the brown mountain lights on a miniature scale in our laboratory in a plasma chamber. And you will see how that applies. But all that said, if we're right about what these are, and let me also say with a caveat here that I don't think that by saying it's a natural phenomenon that explains away all of the more weird experiences people have. I think that a place that naturally has enough energy to produce something like this also triggers a lot of paranormal stuff. Maybe aliens are going there and they're interested. Maybe ghosts are more prominent there because of this energy. But all that said, here are four elements that we've sort of narrowed down that will increase your chances of seeing the lights. Number one, if it's autumn. I think for one thing, you have more visibility, and also the leaves are off the trees and they're producing tannic acid that makes the water that's running in the mountain a little more of an electrolyte that conducts electricity. Number two, it's either raining or a rain has recently occurred. Again, it goes back to that water running on and through the mountain, building up some electrical charges. Number three, if there happens to be extra carbon, that is smoke in the air, from campers or even a forest fire, that might help provide a fuel for the bright lights to consume as they burn. And also, number four, the KP index reads 5 or above. Now, the KP index is a measurement of how disturbed the Earth's overall magnetic field is. And if you don't know anything about that, go to brownmountainlights.com and you can read some about it. But here's how I ended the guidebook, and I'll go ahead and read this to you. If we strip away all the opinions, we ultimately have a place where for over a century, humans from all walks of life have essentially described something simple. Weird lights on a dark mountainside. The geologists focus on piezoelectricity. The chemists focus on gas. The astronomers focus on optical illusions. The physicists focus on plasma. The spiritualists focus on ghosts. The UFO hunters focus on flying saucers. And the conspiracy buffs focus on mind-bending plots. Yet all the while, the songwriters, poets, and artists are just as inspired by their own personal multicolored visions. The mountain is a phantasmagoria of strange tales, but ultimately it is a vast blank slate. It is the tracing board for all manner of human adventure, exploration, wonder, and imagination. Regardless of what they are, the mere concept of the brown mountain lights makes them important. And in this internet age, when the whole universe seems right at our fingertips, how refreshing it is to have a good old-fashioned mystery still quietly waiting to be solved right here in our own backyards. And that's what it is, my friends. Brown Mountain Lights. Perfect time of year to go check them out. There's a similar phenomenon in Norway. It's called the Hestland Lights. And they put a lot of effort into researching those, and also came to the conclusion most of them are plasmas. If you want more information on that, be sure to go to paratemporal.com, T-A-R-A, paratemporal.com, and look at some of the night vision footage that we have. Pretty amazing. When we come back, it'll be time for the Dark 30 Hour. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange.